From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump's senior immigration advisor, Stephen Miller, has been waiting to use the idea of public health to curtail immigration for years. According to the New York Times, the ideas about invoking public health and other emergency powers had been on a wish list of about 50 ideas to curtail immigration that Mr. Miller crafted within the first 6 months of the administration. Now, Trump has suspended green card applications for several broad categories, including family members of the U.S. He's also used the coronavirus pandemic to turn away asylum seekers at the U.S. border. Now, a new book tells the story of one Central American asylum seeker and what motivated him to make his way to the U.S. That story is told by my guest, John Washington, writer, translator, and activist. He's a regular contributor to The Nation magazine and The Intercept, where he writes about immigration and border politics, as well as criminal justice, photography, and literature. His book is called The Dispossessed, a story of asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border and beyond. Welcome to the program, John.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Sally.
So how exactly does this notion of asylum that we have in the United States before Trump taken for granted as a international legal framework, how has it been upended in the era of Trump before we get to the story that you focus on in your book?
I would say that it has been completely upended. Right now, especially along the U.S.-Mexico border, there is really no possibility of obtaining asylum. So according to a number of recent mandates, the whole program is basically shut down. And that is, as you stated in the introduction, you know, the justification is the pandemic. Though we know that that doesn't make much sense because the pandemic is already here, is already in the United States. This is the epicenter. And there is really no evidence that migrants, asylum seekers, refugees have had any hand at all in spreading the virus. And yet, as you state, you know, it was sort of maybe the last piece that the Trump administration has been able to use to really shut down the program. Currently, you know, it is only temporarily suspended. The refugee program as well is suspended, and there's a number of other measures where, you know, the border with Canada and with Mexico are effectively shut down. And, you know, all the visas that you just mentioned, those will not be being issued right now. So this has been, exactly as you say, a part of their agenda for a long time, and they've just been able to harness the fear or the crisis and implement what they've been seeking.
So the people that Trump has demonized, that he has essentially claimed without evidence, are bringing in crime and disease, are real human beings, one of whom you profile in your book, and whose story you tell as a way to humanize, I imagine, and also give a sense of what's a typical story of those who come primarily from Central America seeking asylum under an internationally accepted legal framework, seeking asylum into the United States. Tell me about Arnovis. Who is Arnovis? And give me a sense of how you came to telling his story.
Well, there's a lot to describe about his individual situation. I want to back up just a little bit. So as you said, that there is an international framework for the United States, as well as almost every other country on earth, to grant asylum to people who are persecuted based on a number of certain grounds. And the idea behind asylum protocols, which at least this current international framework has been in place for about 70 years, is to make it safer for people to actually claim asylum, to find security when they are persecuted or when they are in fear. And yet, as I think Arnovis's story makes very clear, and you know, I think his story is emblematic in a sense, but there's so many different stories and variations to the way that people currently are uprooted or unroofed and need to flee their country and then try to find safety elsewhere. It's really an incredible journey that he described to me in great detail. He fled his native El Salvador. He lives on the coast, this gorgeous, pristine, small little town on the coast of El Salvador. And though it's quite a beautiful spot, naturally beautiful spot, it is currently overrun by a number of competing gangs, or two competing gangs, who have made it, especially for young men, but not exclusively, more or less unlivable. And he, by pure accident, ran into the wrong crowd, basically, and he was threatened multiple times. A few of his family members were killed. His brother-in-law had a machete held to his neck. They thought it was him. He received many phone calls, which were aggressive or threatening, and he decided to flee. And he first tried to make it into Mexico and was picked up and deported from Mexico. He was deported, returned to El Salvador. He picked right back up and fled again because he just simply was not safe there and was in very real fear of his death. Picked back up, left again, you know, paid a guide or a coyote, rode on the back of the train, you know, had to pay off officials, was kidnapped multiple times, had to escape a safe house. This is what I described in the prologue of my book. He had to climb a wall and escape a safe house. He was shot at. You know, this incredibly dangerous journey. He made it this time to the United States, asked for asylum, was denied and deported. And yet again, realizing that still he couldn't survive there, this time he took his young daughter for the third trip, who was six when he left with her, took his young daughter, made that same trip again, well over 1,000 miles, through El Salvador, across Guatemala, all the way up Mexico, and came again to the United States, again explained that he was not safe, that he could find no safety where he was or anywhere else in El Salvador, that the authorities there could not protect him. He was actually even also threatened by a policeman. And again, he was denied. But the third time, they actually took his daughter from him. And this happened right at the height of the family separation crisis of 2018. And after only a few days in really squalid conditions in custody of the Border Patrol, they separated his daughter from him and sent him to court and then eventually deported him. They told him that his daughter was either in Florida or New York and could give him no other information whatsoever for nearly a month, for about 30 days. And meanwhile, she was actually in Arizona. He was back in El Salvador. And all of that extreme danger that both he and then his daughter suffered, all of it was simply to ask for protection. And the United States, both in domestic law and by international agreement, promises to afford people protection, and you know, if they qualify, and as they weigh the claim, to at least not punish them. And you know, that too is written into
right. I mean, they can turn you down for asylum, which they have been doing, but there's nothing that justified taking children away from their parents.
Right. And yeah, his daughter, she's now seven. You know, she obviously suffered terribly. I mean, it's really tragic. She's still, you know, it's been a little while since I've seen her personally, but you know, I got to know her and her dad really well. And, you know, she was terribly affected. And as you say, you know, they can turn people down, and they do, and you know, increasingly so. And that too has been a concerted effort on behalf of not only the Trump administration, but it is, I think, reaching its peak under the Trump administration. And the U.S. now is sort of a leader in asylum denial. Before, we at least posed as a leader in being the land of welcome and the land of refuge, but now very much so, we are setting an example for asylum denial and deterrence of asylum seekers. And there's been, as I said, a concerted effort by the administration, stacking the immigration courts and making it just much more difficult for people to access legal counsel, for making sure that they're locked up in really poor and in sometimes dangerous conditions, especially given the pandemic right now. for the duration of their case. And so really a multi-pronged, really problematic effort to, even for people with valid claims, to get them to decide that it's not worth it anymore and that they're going to risk their lives back in the place that they just fled.
Now, a big part of the journey for Central American asylum seekers is, of course, going through Mexico, a very large country, a country that, you know, sits right between Central America and the United States. And for many asylum seekers and or refugees and migrants, that can be the most harrowing part of the journey. What did you find out about the person who is your protagonist in the book that you write, Arnovis, in terms of his experience in Mexico?
Right. So that is a whole other story, really. And I do tell a lot of it in my book. You know, Mexico, too, is party to international agreements to offer asylum to people who need it. And yet they, as well as the United States, often denies people who have meritorious claims. They also make it difficult. The refugee and asylum program, their budget has been slashed significantly in the past couple years in Mexico. And a lot of the people that, especially Central Americans, are fleeing from, some of the gangs in particular, some of the transnational criminal organizations, are very present in Mexico, and in some cases are working with Mexican authorities, whether local police or federal national police. So many people, including Arnovis, he explained this to me at great length, recognize that they can't realistically find safety in Mexico. I profiled another person in the book briefly, who was a young man who fled Guatemala. And he holed up at basically a refugee camp, you know, a migrant shelter, but it's more or less a refugee camp, and waited for his asylum claim to be processed. He waited there for over a year, was mistreated by the asylum officials, was threatened by the asylum officials, was eventually approved, but wasn't even informed that he was approved. And even after he was approved, he wasn't given his any documentation to work or travel freely within the country. So even if you get it in Mexico, it can still be an uphill battle and you still don't find the safety that you've been looking for.
So all of this danger, this difficult journey, even ultimately entering the U.S. if one is able to do so, being separated from one's child, is this all still worth the risk that a lot of these Central American asylum seekers are facing? I mean, is they're fleeing violence, but now they're being met with a different kind of violence.
Absolutely. Well, you know, there have been a number of different means to try to deter migrants and asylum seekers for decades. So beginning in the 1990s, when we first started militarizing the U.S.-Mexico border, that was expressly to deter people from trying to come. And, you know, not exclusively asylum seekers, but also asylum seekers. And even though the only way to enter the United States for people back then and still now was a harrowing journey through the desert, crossing, you know, a dangerous river, hiring a potentially violent guide or coyote, and walking sometimes for days or weeks in a grueling hot desert, you know, you'd think they must have a very valid reason to want to flee. And they did, and they still do. I quote Abraham Lincoln in the book, and he says that people who flee, no matter what color, he's referring to escaped slaves, seldom run if they have nothing to run from. And I think that there is a lesson to be learned there, that when people take such great risk, no matter the circumstances, you can go back to the 19th century or you can look at migration from Africa, from the Middle East, or from Central America today. When people take such grave risk to set out across the Mediterranean in a dinghy, to travel through Mexico on the back of a train, to, you know, dodge bandits and walk for weeks or months across a jungle and then a desert, they have a reason. They're not doing it for fun. They're not doing it just to get a slightly better job. they're fleeing a very real situation that is life or death. And that is, in many cases, what I found. That is certainly the case with Arnovis, who, you know, took his chances three times, including with his six-year-old daughter. He wouldn't have done that. And he loves his daughter immensely, and he wouldn't have even considered putting her in that danger if he wasn't scared that he was going to be killed, or and then she might as well, or she would be left without a father. So, yeah, you know, it is grave, and it is extremely dangerous, and it's unfortunate that this is how people ask for asylum. This is sort of what I began explaining to you. There are other ways. There is a refugee program, and refugee programs are designed where people can apply to be resettled either from their home country or from a safe third country. That would be a safe country that is a neighboring country, or just another one where they found
I understand Trump has reduced the quotas for those refugee programs significantly to where it's just a very, very minuscule amount now, right?
Yeah, so the current number, I think, is 19,000, is right around there for 2020. And that is a ceiling. So very, very likely, especially given the current situation, there'll be far fewer number of refugees resettled than that number. But also, if you look at just Latin America and the Caribbean, then that entire large region where there are a number of current situations, which even the State Department admits, are you know, untenable for people to live in, the number of the ceiling of refugee admittances for 2020 is somewhere just over 1,000 people. So we have seen many different just caravans of more than 1,000 people coming in a day, or you know, tens of thousands leaving from each of the countries that we can mention that are, you know, listed in the State Department.
John, in your book, The Dispossessed, one of the things you do is explain why the idea of asylum, and for a country to offer asylum, to respect the concept of asylum, is actually critical to democracy. Can you expand on that?
Yeah. So, you know, this was something that I was really surprised at finding. I think it makes a lot of sense. What I tried to do is give a lot of context, not only immediately around Arnovis, who we've been talking about, or the situation in El Salvador, but I really wanted to understand the long story of asylum. And what I did is I just tried to trace it back. So some people are familiar with the basic 20th century agreements that we've already mentioned, but those arose out of a few decades long League of Nations sort of efforts to try to establish some protocols. And those themselves then were based on centuries, even millennia-long practices where people offered some sort of safety to their neighbors or to the aggrieved traveler or to the, you know, someone from who just needed to flee. And when I looked at when I found sort of the original institutionalization of asylum, which was in ancient Greece, it was in starting probably around like the 7th century BCE. The asylum accords were arising the same time that the principle of democracy was arising. So they were at least parallel. I wouldn't say that they're linked up integrally, but I think that there is something there where when you start to try to take on responsibility for ruling a state, for doing it in a democratic nature, I think you part of that is being able to provide not only your own citizens, but recognizing that you live in a world, this state or the polity in ancient Greece was part of a greater world. And they needed to offer some way that they could integrate with the rest of the world. And doing so by offering some sort of safety was what, you know, was what we saw starting to rise up. So I think that they are linked. And I, you know, the play by Aeschylus is a Greek writer of tragedies, where we first see the term refugee is also the very first evidence we have of the word democracy itself. So there are links in many different ways. And, you know, I think it makes sense in principle, but they're both based on just this sort of fundamental concept of wanting to be safe, of wanting to have a roof over your head, or to be able to not just worry about the danger of your surroundings. And you rule yourself and you rule your home or your polity or your state, and then you can also provide some safety within that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, John. Good luck with your book. Appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Sonali. Great talking to you.
My guest has been John Washington, writer, translator, and activist. He's a regular contributor to The Nation magazine and The Intercept, where he writes about immigration and border politics, as well as criminal justice, photography, and literature. We've been talking about his new book, The Dispossessed, A Story of Asylum at the U.S.-Mexican Border and Beyond. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. Thank you so much.